Welcome to Try Not to Blink, a podcast about the ups and downs, ins and outs, news, tips, and tricks of those who live the optometry lifestyle. We'd like to thank the amazing people at Valley Contacts who have made this podcast possible. Makers of stellar gas permeable lenses and the oh-so-incredible custom stable scleral lens. My name is Dr. James Diem, and I am on the East Coast, Pennsylvania, joined by none other than Dr. Roya Habibi, somewhere in the tropics. What is up, Roya?
You know, I would like to say, but it's just dizzying. There's so many things that's up. But we have an exciting podcast today.
We're going to learn all the things.
Yes, we have brought back a previous guest that we know you all love. So we're going to talk all about a pickle that I've been complaining about for a while now. I know I couldn't get the words out. A dilemma I put myself in. So I reached out to Dr. Thies about this because I had no idea. I've told you about
She's our expert.
BVVT,
everything.
Brain injury.
All things, yes. Eye movements.
So we're going to talk about everything from like, what to do tomorrow when you have a kid, what you must do. It is no longer acceptable to do a normal exam for a kid. You're going to hear what. We're going to talk about what else, Jimmy?
Cycloplegic protocol.
Yes. What else?
You're going to talk about what is dyslexia?
Oh, I don't know. Yes. Yes.
What is it really? I mean, is it a thing? Is it not a thing? Should you use a survey when you're analyzing your kiddos or adults? What survey should you use? Is it normed? Is it not? Just some really great pearls. And, you know, the battery of tests that you should be doing on a binocular vision workup. Some real pearls.
All right. So circling back, for those who haven't listened, episode 142, over 2 years ago, which honestly I was shook. I was like, is this too soon?
That's crazy.
But no, it has been over 2 years since we've had the Dr. Jackie Thies on our show. Can you believe it's been 2 years?
No, at all. No.
Time is really flying. I want to remind everyone who you are, or anyone who's new to listening, who you are. So you completed, you went to UC Berkeley.
If you've been living under a rock.
Right.
You don't know who she is.
I know, especially recently I've been seeing. Jeez. But she went to UC Berkeley School of Optometry. Then she did a residency training in neurooptometry and binocular vision / strabismus disorders there. After residency, she joined faculty at Berkeley, became the founder in chief of the UC Berkeley Sports Vision and Concussion Clinic. Pretty awesome. Then she went to Kaiser for a couple years, working along with ophthalmology and neurology, treating all those Kaiser TBIs and double vision and Parkinson's patients. And oh my God, let's all run. And then she decided, like, I need more. And so she flew to the other coast, was the founder of Virginia Neurooptometry, a subspecialty neurooptometry private practice within a multidisciplinary center called the Concussion Care Center of Virginia that is located in Richmond, Virginia. She has published and lectured and guest edited and peer reviewed for everything you can think of, including in the journals Brain Injury and Optometry and Vision Science. And recently, some of the things I've been noticing, you are the chief medical officer at Sea Light, which we talked about recently, Jimmy, didn't we? If we didn't, we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
She is an assistant professor at USC. Not the USC everyone's seeing, right? USC?
It's USU.
USU. Shoot. I'm thinking USC, like, nah, wrong. But anyway, Uniformed Services University. Awesome. We'll ask about that too. And you've basically been lecturing at every possible thing.
All the lectures.
Everywhere.
If you're going to a lecture in the next month, she's probably getting it.
Basically.
I sure hope so.
Right? Okay. Another thing that I think is worth saying right before I finish the accolades, you were pre-leaving the West Best Coast. You were Young Optometrist of the Year in California. And you're like, not enough. I'm going to be also the Young Optometrist of the Year in Virginia, too. So just got that on her list last year. So, you know,
I was joking with people. I was like, where do I move to next? But as of this year, I'm now too old to win that award in any sense.
Ah, shucks.
You are now optometrist. You would be optometrist of the year.
Optometrist, exactly. Yeah, maybe you have a new accolade.
Hmm?
I gotta be older for that. Wait, like middle-aged.
You're too young to be that, right? You need to come up with something new. Emerging optometrist or something. Right. I don't know.
Midlife crisis.
I like this. I like this. Well, okay. So first let's do a quick catch up. So obviously right when we talked last was around when you had, you were only a couple months into opening in Virginia, I believe.
Yeah. So I think I just, cause I cold started the pandemic. Did we, were we in 2020 or 2021?
It was in March, 2021.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I was a few months into my cold start. And it was good, you know, for opening in a pandemic, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone, especially a tertiary care. So if I were to go through like things I wish I wouldn't have done again. So number one, my big problem was like, I was a name in California. Like people knew me meaning not like in a, you know, ego way, but in
people knew you. Yeah.
People knew me to refer to me.
Of course.
The neurology department knew me. I had a great referral network. Yes. And then I was like, let me cold start in a place where nobody knows who I am.
Yes.
In a time when you're not allowed to network because of COVID. So I will say the first year and a half was rough because nobody knew who I was. And the best I could do is send cold emails to people to be like, hi, I'm from California. so I will say my practice really picked up in the last year because now people know me. And so it's just kind of, that's been wonderful. And now I'm fully booked and right where I want to be. So that's been awesome.
I mean, real talk though, when you open a cold start, there is like a certain amount of like benchmarking you can do. And then a certain amount of like, you don't really know how it's going to go, right? I mean, like, it's hard to, like, what do you think in opening a practice? And you definitely have a non-traditional practice. It's worth reviewing that in a second. But, like, what is successful? Like, what is growth?
I mean, for me, it was, like, every dollar coming in, right? You're just penny counting every dollar. And I remember asking, you know, Kristen O'Brien. I was like, you know, she's opened so many practices at this point and helped other people open practices. And I was like, at what point do you stop worrying when a patient cancels that you're not going to like make ends meet at the end of the month, right? Like, when do you stop thinking about that when someone cancels and be like, oh gosh. And she was like, you never stop thinking that way. And I respectfully disagree because now I'm full. And when a patient cancels, I'm like, oh, good. I finally have time.
Oh, great. I can chart. Right. I can. It's true.
So there is actually a point, I think, when you're like, okay, I think I'm in a successful place where I'm comfortable. And when a patient cancels because they have a migraine, I'm happy they canceled because it would have been an awful exam if they had a migraine. And I feel like I'm stable enough in my practice that I can handle that.
Awesome. Remind everyone, we sort of alluded to it and hopefully everyone already knows, but like remind everyone what makes your practice unique.
Sure. So obviously number one is the setting. So my clinic is in a multidisciplinary concussion clinic. So we have a physical therapist, we have a neuroendocrinologist, we have a physiatrist, which is a PM&R or a physical medicine rehab doctor. All of us are subspecialists in brain injury, and each of us essentially own our own practices, but we operate within the same building and we co-manage staff and space and things like that. So it's a really neat way to operate autonomously, but in a transdisciplinary setting. So we market together and things like that, refer to each other. But my big thing when I went over there is I didn't want anyone to tell me what to do, especially someone that's not in my profession telling me what to do. So it's been a beautiful practice. And I really lucked out in that because I moved to Richmond sight unseen and just kind of crossed my fingers and hoped it would work out. And it was great.
How did you set that up? Like, did someone approach you on this or you kind of corralled people or how did it work?
So it was kind of luck a little bit, you know, everything, I don't know, for me, it's more serendipity, I guess. But so I was good old Bucknell. I went to Bucknell for undergrad and
right.
I had, right? Pennsylvania connection right
there. Right in my backyard.
So Bucknell is a small but mighty school. And anytime you meet someone from Bucknell, it's like you're instant friends. And there was a PM&R who worked in Kaiser in California who went to Bucknell. Not my class by any means, but she, once we found out we both went to Bucknell and we were in California, we became really good friends and she ended up writing a book called Shaken Brain. And we talked about that on the last podcast.
Yeah.
And I had peer reviewed her ocular chapter, and I was talking to her of like, you know, I think I want to move. I need something new and different. And so that's where her connection was. Well, I know, you know, Nathan Zasler is a really well-known brain injury PM&R on the East Coast. He knows everyone. So you should call him and kind of talk to him and see if he knows of any opportunities. Hmm. And so at the time, he actually had this outpatient concussion care clinic, and he also had an inpatient brain injury unit. And I talked to him on the phone for like an hour, just about my practice and what I do and opportunities. And his response was, well, nobody does what you do in Virginia. So if you come to Virginia, you know, I'll sublet you space and you can start your own practice here. And he's one of those people where you Google him and you're like, oh, yeah, I'm going. Like, I'm on my way. Because one of the reasons that I wanted to move was I wanted to be in an environment where I kept learning. And so there's nothing better than moving to a place with a bunch of subspecialists, because I think I learn something new every day from their practices. So it's been awesome in that way.
Very cool.
So
yeah. What's something you've learned more recently that you think we all should learn?
I mean, my biggest take right now has, I've been really into in the last year, cervicogenic eye pain. So the neck causing eye pain, and literally, so I do eye movement testing and the patient's like, oh, that gives me eye pain. And then we have them palpate certain parts of their neck and all of a sudden the eye pain goes away because the pain is actually driven from their neck, which is crazy. And our PT and I have actually been lecturing together on cervicogenic eye pain, and vision problems and whiplash disorder. So that's been, there's really no research on it. And so she and I have gotten really into how can you differentiate if it's just a neck problem or if it's brain injury and a neck problem. And we're looking at doing research with a couple of other groups to try and figure it out. So
I think that whatever type of eye care, I mean, honestly, healthcare in general, never have I heard of anything like your clinic aside from when I was a student. I did a rotation at Walter Reed, and they have the most amazing brain injury center that is super cool. Like, you sit at a table over every single client that comes there, every single specialist that works there, and they talk about the same patient on like collaborate. It's so cool. And like, it kind of sounds like you get to do that too. I mean, it kind of is a leap of faith to bring together different specialists within different fields of medicine to say, let's make something like this.
Yeah. I definitely think that I'm one of the first to do it, and I hope I'm not one of the last. I've definitely mentored a couple of other neurooptometrists. One of my favorites in Colorado, she'll be starting her practice in a neurology office, which Very I cool. think that's one of the things that, you know, I've talked to other optometrists and they're like, oh, I'm multidisciplinary. I work with an ophthalmologist. And I'm like, well, you know, it's kind of the same discipline, just different specialty of doing it. But where I really see multidisciplinary care going is, you know, optometry should be in, like, how wonderful it would be if an optometrist was just in a pediatric office, right? So it's like, you see the pediatrician, you have reading problems, and you have eye movement problems, or you fail your vision screening, and boom, you come in the next, you're right next door is the optometrist. Or same thing in primary care for diabetes, right? Patient comes in for their primary care exam, and then boom, they get, you know, their exam. I mean, we're so integrated in neurologic care and systemic health that I think we can start thinking a little wider in cost sharing and time saving for people. Because that's the big thing, is if you look at, especially people with multidisciplinary problems, they spend their life just commuting from one doctor's office to another.
Totally.
And if we're all in one place, I think that's the one thing that we'll get in our group, is we have people that'll fly in from another state. And it's nice because they can stay for a week and they can see all of us, and get a really comprehensive evaluation versus having to pinpoint your care elsewhere.
Yeah. Or so maybe you have one or two of the specialties, but you don't have the other. Or you go to someone who claims that they do certain things, but they don't really, or they're not quite as, you know, well-versed in a particular rare presentation of whatever. So, yeah, it's super cool.
We also do flybys. That's what we call it in our office. I love a good little like flyby eval. So it'll be one of those things where, so one, right, we don't take insurance. And that's one of the things that's different about us. And the main reason is insurance kind of beholdens you to a very specific type of exam to get reimbursed. And at least for me, from a visual perspective, 99% of the eye components of an exam aren't always what's wrong with the patient. And what's causing their problem, from a neuro and binocular vision point of view. And so for me, I actually feel more liberated and I have more time per patient by not taking insurance and being beholden to the exam components they need. And I co-manage care as well with other primary eye care providers as well, so that I'm not doing duplicative care, right? If a patient needs a fundus photo, they can do it with their primary care. They don't have to do it with me.
Totally.
But one of the things that we can do is just have, you know, I think it's a neck problem, but I'm not totally sure. Or I think they have occipital neuralgia, but I'm not really sure. And the beauty of that is I can have Dr. Zasler or Dr. Etheridge really quickly come by and just do a quick little 5-minute screen exam. They get an A, meet the other provider, but B, they can confirm it and be like, yeah, they have it. We need to work it up further. And it confirms to the patient that when I'm referring you to a colleague, it's not like, it's not like a revenue burst.
It's not a double tap.
Like it's literally like, we're not wasting your time. We know this is the problem. And I think that's one of the problems that we have in healthcare is you're kind of like, oh, I don't know what it is. We'll send you to the specialist. You go to that specialist and it's normal.
Yes.
And then, right, or nothing comes up. And then you go to another specialist and it's normal. And the patient's ping-ponged around to like 7 different specialists and no one really knows what it is. And so for me, the flyby kind of evals are really, really helpful because the patient's like, okay, it's worth me seeing the other provider, or the opposite, right? Where it's like, I'll have them come in and they're like,
wasting my time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't really think that's it. And then I'm not going to refer you to them, right? Because that's not it. And so it's really helpful to do a little screening. And we've each taught each other within our group how to do our screenings, which I think is also really helpful. I think that's the other thing too, is from a cross-disciplinary standpoint, one of the things that I've been doing a lot more is lecturing to other disciplines on how to do an ocular motor screening and brain injury so that they know how to do it and when to refer when it's appropriate.
Love that idea.
Which I think we can do a lot more of. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of why I asked you to come back, but a little bit less, but kind of, yes. So I want to tell everyone why I've talked a little bit with everyone about how we've started the school screening as a way to, you know, get more clients and try and touch base with all of the different families who maybe haven't heard of us yet. So we're doing school screenings and I'm like all excited about it. It's like, yeah, we're going to have these clients and especially like parents because we're sending parent reports in. Most kids do have generally healthy eyes. So it's just kind of like a fun exercise. Granted, we've gotten a lot of eye exams and a lot of kids that are myopic that have come in. But I was like, oh my God, I'm cracking open a terrible egg that I don't want to manage. Like, I'm really scared about this. I keep like complaining to Jimmy too. He's heard me like complain about this all day long. I don't know what to do for these situations. And I have never had a huge interest in doing anything about it. So my first situation came up like literally day one after our screening, the mom calls and says, you know, this little Sally has been told she's dyslexic. Can you give me an eye exam to check on the dyslexia? And I was like, sure, absolutely. And then I'm like messaging Dr. Thies like, oh my God, what do I do? I have no idea. I don't want to do it. Can you do this all virtually, et cetera, et cetera. So anyways, it is hard. Like, okay, just let's take 2 minutes to talk about dyslexia in the eye because you immediately in like 3 texts taught me something right away, but let's talk about that first. Dyslexia and eye disease.
So I think one of the problems is that dyslexia is a very big umbrella term and it's very misunderstood. I think depending on the provider who's using it as a diagnostic. So in my opinion, the best person to diagnose dyslexia is somebody who has a master's in education or somebody, right, so who really understands linguistics. So at the heart of dyslexia, it's a language disorder. It is usually, and there's multiple theories on what causes dyslexia. Some, the most common or most widely accepted, so again, it's not even definitive.
Right.
And that's what makes it so difficult.
Right. Sometimes people say, I have dyslexia, right? And you're like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Exactly. So the current theory or the most accepted theory is that it is an auditory problem, actually. So it's a phoneme awareness issue. So when you think about learning how to read, the way that we interpret it as language is that you associate the symbol of a letter with the sound of the letter, and you put the sounds together to make a word, and the words then create language. So at the heart of it, I always like to think of dyslexia as a language disorder.
Okay.
Which means that they're having trouble interpreting the language. Now, the problem with that then is that no matter how they read, they're having trouble kind of understanding what they read or reading fluently, or they take longer to read. And so pretty much anyone who says that they have trouble reading, they're like, oh, I'm dyslexic.
Right.
Right. And there is no specific way to diagnose. I mean, there's different neuropsych tests and things like that. So I'm a really big proponent of multidisciplinary care for dyslexia. I think a lot of kids, one of the problems is that recent literature is starting to use eye movements to differentiate people with dyslexia and not. And a lot of the people doing this research are neuropsychologists. And I always like to think of them as different problems. You can have, right, like a dog can have ticks and fleas. So someone can have dyslexia and an eye movement problem.
Absolutely.
And the problem is that both of them are pretty prevalent developmentally. They're more prevalent in people who have atypical development. So premature birth. And is a big one, right? And that makes sense. The brain really finalizes all of its processing prematurely, or kind of in the last
in
months
phase.
Of gestation. So if you were born prematurely, your eye movements did not develop appropriately. And then if you don't have the right intervention, so we know there's a lot of preterm infants or kids with developmental delay that are put into these high intensive OTPT programs that are excellent. I work with one. There's one that literally across the street from my office that is amazing. And these kids do really, really well. But if a kid doesn't get that, then they're not going to develop their eye movements appropriately. So, and I always ask, so what's the first step in understanding, you know, if a kid comes in, the first thing I always want to know is, well, were they born preterm? Because that's just going to be a risk factor for having an eye movement problem. But also, what was the mother's birth pattern like? So when we think about eye movements, some say ocular motor, but it's also coordinated with the vestibular system. So the vestibular system develops by 5 months of gestation, but the way that you develop your kind of sense of balance and movement and the vestibular system is based actually on the baby moving around in the womb as the mom's moving around. Hmm. So if the mom actually has bed rest for a lot of her birth, the kid's not getting the vestibular input to develop their vestibular system. So they may have vestibular problems as well. So the other symptoms, because you would ask, like, what do you ask, right? So things that I want to know if I'm just quickly trying to figure out, is it dyslexia or is it dyslexia plus an eye problem?
Right.
Is, are you carsick? So carsickness is common. And I love, I talked to our PT about this because, you know, she was always taught that carsickness is normal. And I was like, there's a difference between common and normal. Common just means a lot of people have it, and it's just atypical development of the vestibular system, which you can train away with vestibular PT or ocular motor PT sometimes. And then we also know that the problem with vestibular disorders is it causes problems with crowding. So I will then say, do you feel anxious in visually crowded areas? A lot of the other diagnosis I'll add into this talk that we can have today is ADHD. So there's a lot of kids as well, whether it's dyslexia, ADHD, or eye movement problems that are misdiagnosed with ADHD or dyslexia, but actually just have an eye movement problem. And then there's some kids that have both.
Right.
And so that kind of makes it complicated. So that's why when you sent me that text of like, what do I do? I was like, well, this is not a text message.
I know. I was like, oh.
It's not easy.
Give me 1, 2, 3.
Yeah. And I was like, well, here's my comprehensive battery, right, of what I would do. But it really starts with first understanding the problems. The other big thing that I always say, so in my opinion, when I get a kid, the first thing I want to figure out is, you know, maybe it's just an eye movement problem, and big red flags for me will come in the intake. So dyslexia as a language disorder just means I have trouble interpreting language. It does not mean I get dizzy when I'm in the car. It doesn't mean I get headaches when I read. I've had so many kids sent to my office for dyslexia, and I'm like, well, what happens when you read? And like, oh, I get a headache. I'm like, what? That's not dyslexia, right? Like, that's an ocular motor problem. That's an easy one to be like, oh, this is an eye movement problem.
Yep.
So for me, it's the physical symptoms that are super helpful when you're first starting, just like going down this path of should I be looking at eye movements or not?
Yeah. I mean, I know this is probably a bad thing, but I'm in a real talk right now. I feel like so many people use dyslexia as like, I can't learn. Right. And I don't think that that's fair, because there are so many people that I know that say they're dyslexic and are crazy successful people. Like they do. You can, it's not a barrier to being able to learn and being able to do things. I don't think, I mean, that might be the wrong perception on my part. Maybe I'm uneducated in dyslexia to be able to say that, but I like that question. So like questions you could ask while you're doing, you know, your intake. Do you get a headache? Do you get car sick? What are some other things? Because I'm asking this family, and she's doing well in school, although she's struggling reading, and that's the dyslexia thing. That's why it got to that diagnosis. But like, what are other things that you would include into your questionnaire?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the big ones that I use is the Convergence Insufficiency Symptom Survey. It's validated. It's easy. One of the things people underestimate about it, or to keep in mind about CISS, it was intended to be able to help kind of look at symptoms with reading, problems with eye movements, but it is not specific to convergence insufficiency. So you can have someone with saccadic dysfunction, and they can have a pretty high CIS score, but they won't have CI. And so where people will sometimes kind of pigeonhole themselves is that they don't actually look at saccades or do any type of saccadic testing. They do the CISS, they do cover test, they do NPC, and they're like, no CI, you're fine. I'm like, well, the CISS is not specific for CI. It just says that there's high symptoms of reading that could be due to an eye movement problem, the way that I interpret it. Because there is no other studies that have looked at, that, and there should be, right, of people who have CIS scores, what other eye movements are also impacted, or of people with high CIS scores who don't have CI. And I think that would be helpful, but I think it's a helpful survey. I think it's also helpful because the questions that it asks are common problems in kids with eye movement problems in reading that are not questions that normally these kids are asked. So for instance, usually we ask, well, is it blurry? Do you see double? But I think the ones that are super helpful is, how often do you feel like you reread? Do you have to keep use your finger to keep your place? Do you feel like the words move on the page? And those ones, the funny thing is, like the kid will be like, and I like that, is it always, sometimes, frequently, or never? So for me, if it's dyslexia, it should be always, right? Because I always have a language problem.
Yep.
So if it's I intermittently have trouble keeping my place, I intermittently have to reread. Well, ocular motor is an intermittent problem, but to me, dyslexia is not. So that's, it's also, I also look at the numbers. I don't just look at the total score. I look at, is it frequently, sometimes, always, or never?
That makes sense.
Again, the other thing, and that's funny, is when you do these questions with the parent there, and the parent is always like, you know, you see double? I get that a lot, where the kid's like, I see double all the time. And they're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know? You're like, oh, yeah, no one asked. I'll usually when, and kids are nonspecific, they're not great reporters. So how's reading? Bad. What's wrong? What's hard? What do you not like about it? It's hard.
Yeah. You're like, no, it's
thank
true.
Thank you for your really eloquent speech.
Yeah, thank you for really helping me figure this out quickly.
I don't like it. Yeah. Well, and the problem too is there's some psychological issues that kids will have with reading too, because reading really differentiates kids early on as far as performance, and you can tell when they put them in different reading groups.
Totally.
Right?
Totally.
So you have the really good readers, not so good readers, poor readers. And I don't care how you mask it. I love when you'll have a kid who went to some school that's trying to like mask it. And they'll be like, you know, this is the bears, this is the gorillas, this is the giraffe reading group. And you'll get a look, like kids still figure it out. I'll have a kid come in and be like, oh, so why are you here? And they're like, well, you know, I read like a bear, but my mom wants me to be a gorilla. kids can quickly pick up
they
on
know.
Like, oh, I'm not as good as
they're
them.
They're in the dumb
like,
kids
I'm not
group.
As good as them. Yeah. And the problem with that is, especially early on, when that starts to happen for kids, I mean, that's their whole, you develop kind of this self-awareness profile of I'm not as good as, right? And then there's this anxiety component to reading.
Totally.
And if it's there long enough, you just start to hate reading. And then the other problem can be frustration. And that's one of the things I was talking to one of my parents. We'd gotten the kid better, and I always like feedback at the end of like, how have you noticed life is better? And they were like, you know, the big thing for me actually is quality of life, of me not having to yell at Johnny to keep doing his homework, right? Because usually what'll happen is they get symptoms or they get distracted, and then homework is a hour-long process of working with the kid and screaming at the kid to do their work.
Yes.
And then when actually reading is easy, the kid just does their homework really quick and goes to do the things they enjoy because it's not taking them as long.
Yes.
It's not hard. And that was a component I never thought about from a family life perspective of like, oh, I'm actually helping your dynamic of
yeah.
not having to fight your kid to do homework all the time, which is kind of cool.
100%.
I never promise that to patients or parents, but it's neat when it happens.
No, it's true. I mean, like being a parent is hard, especially with your, like you just would want to, I don't know, but I would just do my kids' homework if it annoyed me that much. That's probably why so many parents end up doing their kids' projects because they're tired of hearing their kid cry about it. But
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe Jimmy has more to say about that. You haven't gotten the homework phase yet.
You're the one with the kids. Yeah, we have.
We got homework. We got homework every night, actually. And yeah, it's intense. I mean, it could really be. You know, I think I tried to employ some of my, you know, vision therapy, vision rehabilitation tricks. You know, I try to have her sitting at a table that's appropriate and she's sitting, you know, good posture. I try, you know, because like she wants to hang out like half on a chair, half standing, TV's on, you know, like at least a little bit, you know. But yeah, it's tough, you know, and the right time is important. Get a little bit, you know, later in the evening, it's difficult. We went on a vacation earlier this year and we got all the homework and we waited till the day we got home to do all the homework.
Brilliant.
And yeah, and she got like a 70 on a test and, you know, I was ready to rip her head off. And I'm like, you know, come on, you're not going to get into Harvard now, you know? And,
yeah, third grade really broke it for her.
Yeah. Kindergarten. This is kindergarten.
Oh my God. Yeah, you give grades in kindergarten. Oh,
yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Math test. Didn't do good.
Look at your school. She's in like, the top school in the area.
Yeah, in Hazleton. Yeah, it's great.
not competitive at all. Yeah. Definitely doesn't have.
But anyway, no, I, you know, and we went on another vacation and we did a little bit every day, you know, and broke it up. So we were learning. We're learning with her, and certainly it's there is a lot of learning going on, both for the parent and the child, right? Yeah. So it's really interesting. Did you ever use the brain injury vision symptoms survey? It's like
the IVSS.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just a couple extra questions. You use that a little bit too. Is that, do you find it to be better, worse, the same? Who cares?
So I have problems with both surveys. So I think I like the CISS because it's a validated questionnaire. One of my problems with CISS is
keep going.
The first question should be, do you read? Because sometimes I'll have some
then you
real
can just
good
stop, right?
false negatives because people will be like, do you have double vision when you read? No. And they just write no on everything. And then I'm like, well, right. Do you read? And they're like, no. Like, well, this was a worthless survey. Because they're telling you accurately, yeah. I don't get those symptoms because they just don't do that thing.
Right.
Yes.
How
do you think electronic devices affect reading now, though? Oh. I mean, like, because there's, I had a guy today tell, I'm like, because I'm talking about presbyopia, you know, and I'm like, you know, you need something to see up close or to read. And he's like, but I don't read. As he has his phone, like, blinking in his hand, looking at his, you know, size 30 font text messages. I'm like, no, I don't read. I'm like, yes, you're reading right now. That's look, you know, but I realize I have to rephrase how I say it because I always say reading and people are like, what do you mean by that? You know, but it's up close. It's doing things. I should just say looking at your phone and just forget about it. Cause that's what people are doing.
Exactly.
You need these glasses to look at your phone. Messages. Forget it. Yeah. Just, this is your phone glasses.
Right.
Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no. So I think the electronics has been an interesting adage to reading because it used to be in the past that I was advocating for computer-based stuff. And the main reason was actually for font size or for increased spacing. So I used to be asking for electronic mediums in the past. I would say when I was in my residency, so about a decade ago, before it was
get old.
Kind of so ubiquitous to have, you know, media the way it is now because of COVID. So pre-COVID is really where I would differentiate it as far as learning goes. But it's interesting because I, before, was writing all these letters to be like, can I have the kid to get, you know, mediums that are electronic so they can increase the font size and they can decrease, you know, increase brightness, especially for kids with low vision. And now I'm actually writing more letters of, can I please get a paper book for this kid?
Yeah.
And so I think there's a couple of things when it comes to electronics that are going to impact your reading. So the first thing is going to be cicades and vergence in accommodative facilities. So the first thing that happens when we now have a task that's farther away is I'm now looking far away and up close when we're taking notes. Before, we were taking notes in the margin or really on a piece of paper right next to the book. And now when you have a computer or an iPad, it's farther away. So if somebody has trouble with cicades making an eye movement quick or kind of a large eye movement from A to B, you're increasing the ability to have error. So a lot of times I have kids who have trouble taking notes or they have trouble interpreting what they're doing, or especially with math. Like, could you imagine now kids get math on the computer? And so they literally are looking at the computer, writing down on their piece of paper, and then they have to put their answer into the computer, which if somebody has trouble changing their focus from near to far, they're going to have a huge range of error of like accidentally, especially if words move because they have convergence problems, right? Or numbers move, all of a sudden now I'm not translocating the numbers correctly and doing the math wrong. I might actually be doing the process of math right, but I accidentally wrote 18 instead of 81. And people will say, oh, that's dyslexia. But if I accidentally was looking at it, intermittently got double vision and literally did see 81 instead of 18 because I intermittently had double vision, then you're going to have a lot of these. And that's the kind of the cases I'm getting where it's like they're just misdiagnosed as dyslexia and they actually just have intermittent double vision from, you know, convergence problems or trouble with cicades. So with text, I'm now feeling like I'm having a harder time. And now there's books aren't even available. Now I'm actually getting like pushback from schools of like, well, we don't have it available. And then I get a slap back with the ADA. So I'm a big fan of being like, well, it's funny, but actually you have to provide the medium that a kid would need. I used to use ADA to advocate that they get electronic use, and now it's the opposite. I'm advocating for paper use.
That's interesting. Cool.
And then the other thing that is helpful from a paper medium that's harder, you can do it, but it's harder on a computer screen, is if kids have trouble with crowding. So kids with amblyopia are going to have trouble with crowding. Kids with vestibular conditions are going to have trouble with crowding. And they need to use a line guide or a bookmark. It's hard to use those on computers. And so that's sometimes I'm asking for a paper book just so they can use a bookmark or a line guide to keep their place.
Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. Okay. To kind of circle back to what we were talking about when I originally reached out to you, but like, what are some ways to incorporate into a, you know, maybe a standard private practice where they are, where like, for me, let's just say for me, I see kids, I love doing normal exams for anyone in the family, but what's maybe, you know, a couple things I should consider, whether it's like creating a whole separate kids reading analysis, or I don't know, what is something that you could envision a general optometrist doing to help screen kids like this?
Yeah. So the first thing is you need to have the equipment. And so I know everyone's so funny about like, oh, but I don't really do this. And I was very, you know me, I'm very open and honest about how I feel about it. But my opinion is the basic ocular motor battery to be able to screen for pediatric ocular motor problems should be part of your exam stuff. And if you don't have it, then you shouldn't be seeing kids. It's kind of like being like, oh, I love to see adults, but I don't screen for IOP. Like, it's part of the adult exam. So for me, there's some, and you don't necessarily have to do all the rehab, but if you're going to be seeing kids, you need to be able to differentiate that. Cause I get really frustrated when I have kids where they've for years been seeing a pediatric quote unquote optometrist who's never actually done near point testing on them. So, and the thing that gets me too is you can bill for it. So a 92060 is a sensory ocular motor exam. So you can bill for it. And then not only that, but the equipment from an ROI perspective is way cheaper than some of the things that you're buying for your office, like an OCT or a visual field. Like the ROI of BV equipment for testing is going to be less than $100. So it's maybe it'll be more if you get some of the fancier stuff. But again, if you really want basics. So the first thing, the first thing I always say when you start with peds is cycloplegia. You need to have 1% tropicamide. Basics being basics. Rule out latent hyperopia and astigmatism. I've had a lot of kids come in and they can eke by. That's the thing with kids. They have their ciliary body is like the Hulk. Like they can really focus through anything. And then secretly they're a +4, right? And the +4 is going to be giving them headaches in third grade, but it won't bother them in kindergarten. So cycloplegia and actual time for cycloplegia. And the way that I do it in my exam, because the key is people say, I just don't have time. You just have them come back on a different day, or you prescribe it for them and have them come in cycloplegic. So for me, usually most kids and parents are not ready for cycloplegia when they come in. No matter how much my front desk tells them to be prepared for it when they come in, they're not. And so they're like, oh, you know, Johnny's got a baseball game later. Fine. You know, it's not life or death for them to come back for cycloplegia. And so I just have them come back on a different day when they are prepared to be. And I always tell them, be prepared to be dilated for 24 hours. So don't have a test the next day. Don't have a big baseball game the next day. Be prepared for it. And then make sure, I always use anesthetic. That's the other big thing, is that a lot of these kids have PTSD because someone strapped them down and drops them.
Sprayed it in their face.
Oh, gosh. And I have had so many, and if you can't get the drops in appropriately, you're not going to get enough hyperopia out. So it's actually imperative that you get it in there. So my trick for that is, I always tell the kid, I'm going to put in a drop with a white cap, and that drop stings for 5 to 10 seconds. And then I'm going to wash it out with this red cap. And then the nice thing is, by 10 seconds, it's anesthetized. I put the cyclo in. It doesn't hurt, so I'm not a liar. I told them the first one would hurt, and it did. The second one did not. So already I got trust with them, which is huge. And then number two is, the red drop doesn't hurt. So then I, a few minutes later, will be like, can I put another one in? And they're like, oh, please. And you'll literally have a kid just open their eyes because they think you're washing out the first one.
Interesting.
So that has worked really well for me. And I've gotten I've easily gotten one or two extra diopters of hyperopia more than everyone else. And then you wait 20 to 30 minutes, which means they go sit in the waiting room while I go do something else, or I see another patient or something like that. But I always say, bring them back. If you don't have time to actually wait 30 full minutes for them to be cycloplegic, bring them back for a different day. It is worth it for a kid with reading problems. Because the number of times you have someone where it's secretly they're just getting intermittent blur because they have some astigmatism. And studies have shown that even for someone, you know your tables for what's an appropriate amount of hyperopia for kids. But if someone has an atypical amount of hyperopia, even if it's just by plus a half or plus one, giving them that extra amount has shown to be increasing reading speed, reading duration, and decreasing headaches.
Do you even find value in refracting them, or whether it's refraction, retinoscopy, whatever, before
drops? I do. I do. And the main reason that I do, and I'll usually do that on my intake exam. I won't necessarily do it on the after. It all depends. I'm very problem focused in how I do my exam, but I think refraction is helpful because I want to know how much plus they can actually tolerate.
Yep.
And actually see through. As much as I love the concept of reading glasses, think about with adults how easy it is to have reading glasses and have to put them on and off and on and off and on and off. I want to know how much plus that kid can take at distance and what they'll see at up close. And sometimes, let's say they're secretly a plus four, but they can only tolerate plus one at distance. If I'm not giving them a bifocal, I might start them with plus one and see, as long as it's not amblyogenic, see how it goes. So that the kid can wear them all day long at school. Because if they can wear them all day long and not have to be constantly taking them on and off, they're going to be more successful with it.
Absolutely.
So that's usually why I think dry refraction is helpful.
Yep.
The other thing that can then, and then you just forewarn the parent of, you know, your kid is, like, I had a kid the other day, it was like a plus eight, and they didn't worn nothing, and they were 12 years old. Oof. And I was like, start like a plus three. We're gonna work our ways up to, he wasn't amblyogenic. Sometimes those, like, you don't know how that works. You're like, how are you not, I don't know,
20,
and then you have someone that's plus three and has amblyopia. It's you know,
it's weird.
It's such a mix. But you sometimes, and then you just tell the parent, you know, we're gonna work them into it and probably change the prescription every 3 to 6 months depending, until we can get them in the full amount.
Yep.
And that's okay too. I know we were all, at least I was taught, and you were at Berkeley, so I know you were taught the same way, that you prescribe half to one off of the cyclo.
Yep.
And I think that's really age appropriate for kids under 8 to 12. I think it's easy. They adapt to it pretty quickly. But if you're getting a teenager who's a latent hyperope that was undiagnosed, it doesn't always work that well.
Yeah.
And that's where the dry refraction in the older ones is helpful.
Makes sense. So
I don't waste my time with dry refraction in anyone under the age of 7.
Yeah.
Just so
okay.
Clear.
Okay. Yeah. I like that answer.
Yeah.
So cycloplegic refraction, must do.
Yeah, step one.
What are the other things?
Okay, number two is cover test. So cover test at distance and then cover test at near. At near, if there is any ESO, you have to cyclo before you do anything else, because you have to rule out there's not a hyperopic component. So if there's ESO, you're going to cyclo, have the kid come back with the glasses and recheck to see if the ESO went away. If it went away, great. Give them some time with the glasses. But if it didn't go away, then you kind of have to dig a little deeper into how the ESO is impacting their function. So we've got cover test. The next thing I do is prism bar vergences at distance and at near, and near point of convergence. So I use a Brunel accommodative ruler. It's fast. It's easy. It has all the age norms on there. So it's really quick to be able to do. It's cheap. It travels. I mean, it's a ruler, but it's great. and then near point of accommodation. Near point of accommodation should be monocular, not binocular, because kids can have asymmetric findings. And oftentimes you're going to have better NPA binocularly than you will monocularly. So I have a lot of kids that'll pass it binocularly, but secretly monocularly they're struggling, and that's where all their symptoms are coming from, is that
the monocular eyes
over time are fatiguing. The key with near point testing is to repeat it. So usually 3 to 5 times. And I know everyone's like, oh, this sounds so laborious. And it's like, well, yeah, but you can have them come back on a different day in a scheduled exam slot, so it doesn't ruin your schedule, and you can bill it as an ocular motor exam. So, you know, it's, you don't have to think of it as like all these extra things I'm doing for free. You're doing a service. You can bill for the service. And if you're going to do it, I think you should do it the right way. The last thing you want to do is do it, not do it the right way, and then the kid thinks they're getting the right care and they're not.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
So we look at convergence, fusional, and then proximal using the near point ruler. We look at accommodative amplitudes. The big thing for me is also accommodative facility. So get yourself some flippers, +/-2 and +/-150, and you do facility testing on each eye. And you're looking, obviously, to see if they have a focusing spasm. You can do, if you want to cut corners, you can do it for 30 seconds. But I will say, candidly, the minute is really helpful if you're really trying to eke out a kid who has symptoms, the minute. And that's one of the things I've noticed the most in concussion disorders, where people are not diagnosing the ocular motor problem, is the endurance factor. So if you only do it for 15 seconds, they're fine. But if you do it for 30 or 45 seconds, they're not fine. So I think some of the reasons that we're missing things is because we're not doing the full 60 seconds. And I will tell you, like, 60 seconds feels like the longest minute of your life when you're doing testing like this.
Totally.
So we did accommodation, we did convergence. The next thing you want to do is smooth pursuit. You'd be surprised how many kids doing a smooth pursuit can't do it. And you're just going slowly back and forth and their eyes can't follow it. And then up and down. So you don't even have to buy equipment for that. You just find a target for them to look at. Saccades. So for me, I test them in two different ways. Number one is using the DEM, the developmental eye movement test, which I think if you're going to be working with someone of like, is this dyslexia, is so helpful. So number one is it has age range norms. So the problem with reading is that not everyone's the same, and some people can be bad readers, but it would be appropriate for their age. So if you actually look at the norms on the DEM, you'll actually see that the standard deviation of what is considered normal gets smaller and smaller as they get older, which is really helpful. So if you have a kid, because I've had kids who are, you know, going to kindergarten and getting 70% on their math test, and the parent comes in really concerned because they're making reversals. I'm like, well, yeah, they're five. They're allowed to make reversals, right? Like, the parents don't know that. Parents don't think about the concept of like, well, there's an age where it's okay to make reversals, and there's an age where it's not. And there's an age where it's okay to make errors when you're reading, because that's how you learn, is by making errors. They're not going to be perfect. So the DEM is great for that. We know from a dyslexia standpoint that, kids with dyslexia have longer fixation duration, which makes sense. They have a harder time encoding the visual information phonetically. So they should be slower on the vertical subtest. They should have slower processing speed, but their vertical and horizontal subtest, in my opinion, should be the same, because the processing of the phonemes of the numbers should be the same. So if they have trouble on the vertical and the horizontal, but their ratio is normal, then you know that to me is consistent with dyslexia.
Okay.
And then how you help that kid is you write a letter to allow them to have more time on tests and assignments. And I will use the DEM standard scores to advocate for how much time. So for instance, if the kid is 3 standard deviations below age norms, I'll request triple time. If they're 2 standard deviations, I'll request double time. Mm. And that's helpful, because if you're just saying more
for tests
time,
or for what? What do you say?
I say for all tests and assignments, and including written assignments. Because if it's going to take the kid, so if you think about testing, if it takes me 2 times longer to read the instructions, that amount of time is taken out of my ability to respond. So they definitely need more time on tests and assignments. But assignments as well. If you give Johnny an hour of reading, but his processing speed is 3 times slower, that hour for any normal kid is going to take him 3 hours. And then what ends up happening with these kids, and this is why they hate school. I would hate school too if I had slow processing speed, because every teacher is giving a kid an hour of something, but that kid takes 3 hours to do that hour.
Yeah.
In which case now you just gave the kid 26 hours of homework to do in one night. Right. Yeah. And then the other thing I'll say is only give the, you know, if we're giving visual or reading, only give what's absolutely necessary if you can't give the allotted amount of time for them to do it.
Yeah.
Right. Cause we can be honest. Some stuff is waste of time.
It's just like they right? wanted to give homework.
Yeah. Yeah. And what they don't realize is that for this kid who is trying hard, and that's what I've found about all these kids, especially when they're young, they are really trying hard. And they get so frustrated because they're spending their entire life outside of school doing schoolwork.
Yep.
And I think they should be outside playing and having fun and being a kid. And so that's where you as an eye doctor can be really helpful in advocating that they get play, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what I feel like I'm advocating for, is that they still get to be a kid even though they have slowed processing speed.
Totally.
They're not punished for the fact that they have slowed processing
speed. Well, they don't know better, and they just feel like, why is it so much harder for me than my friends?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
So then...
No, you go.
I was just going to say, so then what's helpful about the horizontal subtest is that if, let's say, you have the vertical, so you have that baseline of where they should be. Now, let's say their horizontal takes exponentially more time. Well, now you know that they're, and the only difference is there's more eye movements. That tells me their eye movements are impacting their reading speed. And what's nice about that is we can fix eye movements. We can make them faster. We can make them more accurate. So we have potential to help that kid's reading ability, giving them vision therapy for their saccades or their whatever eye movement's abnormal for them, so that they can be a more accurate reader. The other thing I'll do when I do the horizontal subtest is I'll use a line guide. You can literally buy line guides from Amazon for like $5. They're awesome. And you do the horizontal subtest with the line guide and without the line guide. And so if with the line guide, they get to age norms, then you can advocate again that the kid's allowed to use the line guide in school, which again means you have to advocate that they get paper text. So a lot of working with these kids, even if you don't do vision therapy, is just advocating that they get the appropriate resources to be successful in school.
Totally. I like this.
Did you ever use the, as you were talking about the DEM, it came back to me, the rapid number naming, there was a name for it. Why am I forgetting it?
Talking about King Divic?
King Divic, yeah. Is that, it's not something you do anymore, or do you do it, or just
I've never
bought
used
it
yeah. personally, and it's not out of I've met with Dr. Divic, and I have nothing but respect for him. And he and I have actually had conversations about this. Of I really find value in the vertical subtest, and the King Divic lacks it. That's the sheer reason I like the DEM a little bit better.
So the
point of the King Divic is as a sideline screener for sports. That is
right.
The point of the King Divic. And so you use it, you baseline the kid,
quick.
They get a concussion, you do it again. It is a quick baseline function. That is the point.
Right.
Whereas for me, from a diagnostic standpoint, both in concussion but also developmentally, I want to know how much of this is a visual processing problem versus how much of this is actually an ocular motor problem. And the nice thing about the DEM is it also has age norms for me to compare against. Now, it's only age to 14, but if I get a 55-year-old adult and they read like a 10-year-old, it's abnormal.
There's a problem there.
You can apply it.
The battery test that you just said is fantastic. When you have a concussion patient, you know, and they're like barely able to open their eyes, you know, they're light sensitive, they have the hat and sunglasses on, they're bothered by sound and movement, you know, I bust into the room and they're just like huddled in the corner, like, don't speak, you know, like my staff usually writes a note on there, like, don't go in the room like you normally do. Do you titrate that list down a little bit? I mean, can you just kind of look at the person and you're like, yeah, you're screwed. We need to help you. You know, like, I know there's things here that we need to do. They've been through PTOT speech, maybe. You're the last house on the block. Do you do it all? I mean, if you do, great. You know, and do you find that it's difficult to do sometimes?
So I do it all. The difference really with concussion ocular motor dysfunction versus developmental ocular motor dysfunction is symptoms. So when I'm doing all of these tests, number one is I always ask how they're feeling, and I tell them, you know, if you get an atypical symptom while we're doing this, and it can be anything, brain fog, dizziness, nausea, fatigue, headache, let me know. So in my developmental population, they don't really feel anything. Once in a while, you'll get dizziness or nausea. And usually, if you really do a good case history, you realize, like, they had a concussion that just was not diagnosed. They had a concussion. Like, oh, yeah, this all started when Johnny fell out of a tree.
Right.
But the concussion population is going to be way more symptomatic, in which case you're taking a lot more breaks. And then the symptoms build on itself. So there are times where I always tell patients I don't want more than a 6 out of 10 symptom. But I need to know what eye movements are causing what symptoms, because it's going to guide my treatment. And I also need to know how long they can do certain eye movements, because it guides my treatment. So to give you an example, the other device that I use for saccadic testing is called the OMAP. It's the ocular motor assessment tool. Think of it as the Bernal ruler with a fancy attachment to it. So it's not that fancy at all. But it's eloquent in how you can use it, because what you do is it's fixed distance, so it's standardized. They make saccades back and forth between two targets, and they go for a full minute, and you have an app that you can count the eye movements as they go. So you can actually see if they fatigue over time, and the app will actually stratify how many eye movements they made per 15 seconds. So you don't have to do all that math. You just click a button when you see the eyes move, so a tech could do it. But I like to know how long can they go for before they get symptoms, you know? And so concussion, they'll go for like 20 seconds and then they want to throw up. Whereas I'll have a kid maybe where they can go for 45 or they can go for the full 60, but they're inaccurate. And that's where kind of being able, you know, I also use eye tracking. I do a lot of other things within my practice that helps me figure out, is it a endurance issue? Is it a strength issue, or is it an accuracy issue? And you have to use multiple things to be able to figure it out. But from a primary care standpoint, you're not going to have that. You're just really looking for me, it's endurance. And I think that's one of the things that's not tested enough. And that's why I like the OMAP, is what is your endurance? So if a kid can make a ton of saccades in 20 seconds, and then the last 20 seconds, they're like, well, I can't do this, I'm tired. Well, no wonder you can't read. Like, your eyes get tired, right? So for me, I prescribe based off of it. I will say, people always ask, based on time, you know, a pediatric ocular motor eval for me, granted, I've been doing it for a long time, 10, 15 minutes. To do all of this testing and more, to be honest, it does not take that long. Concussion, 45 minutes. And it's mainly because I have to stop because they want to throw up, and I have to let that settle so we can start the next thing. And so there's a lot of time and breaks for them to let their symptoms come back down.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you,
from a little kid, pretty fast.
Do you do any computerized ocular motor assessments?
I mean, I have some eye trackers. And I guess that would be the computerized. And I look at those more from an accuracy standpoint of how accurate are the eye movements. But it's not necessary nor as helpful for me, depending on what I'm looking at. My problem, again, brain injury practice, everyone's light sensitive.
Right.
And so most of the problems I've had, even with the eye trackers, is they have you following a black target on a white background. And if you're glare sensitive, you can't. Even right. if, you know, and so that's been frustrating for me. Of it's literally the way that they designed the software makes right. it hard to use.
Yeah.
Right.
Same thing. And the other thing I find in the brain injury population is that most of the software moves too fast. And so they just can't keep up with it. And that's an issue too. Because for me, smooth pursuit, you could test it slower to see if it's abnormal. And that's kind of where I think you could easily do this practice the way Roya was kind of asking, in a very low tech way. You don't need all the tech to do this. You can do very bare bones and get by just fine.
Totally.
And that's what I was saying, you know, your battery, there's no, so when people are like, oh, well, I can't, you can, you can totally do all this testing and it doesn't cost money and you can make more money off of it.
Yeah.
Your ROI is very quick. You can make back your equipment in literally one or two visits. So there's no reason not to do it.
I mean, I think
so. What about therapy? What's the next step?
I think honestly, therapy could be a whole other conversation.
Session.
We may have to hold it because we are getting hot.
I need to know though. Do you do it? Do you do it now? Or you know, yes or no? And if you do or don't, you know, you don't have to go into it.
Oh yeah, no, I do vision therapy in my practice.
Okay.
I do 100% home based, and they all get better.
Okay.
So
cool.
The key is compliance. And so I like to say, you know, when it comes to compliance, you as the optometrist are the coach. And so if somebody isn't doing it, I gave them too many exercises. It was too hard. They couldn't implement it in their life. And so then I have follow-ups with my patients every 1 to 3 weeks, depending on how compliant they are or good at doing it on their own. Some people need more frequent visits. And it's just because them knowing they have to see me means they have to do it. Yep. And they don't have the opportunity to do it in office. So I think sometimes I've talked to people who do both. They do in-office and home-based. And they always complain to me that their home-based doesn't work. And I'm like, well, yeah, because even me, right? I've gone to physical therapy. If I know that I'm going to be doing it in office.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not doing it.
But if in office you're just going to villainize me for not doing it at home, I'll do it at home, right? Yeah. So it's all the mentality. I think by doing in office, you give them an excuse to not do the home-based. And in my experience, people who do it every day get better faster than if they do it once a week for a long period.
Yeah.
And it's consistency. Anytime you're looking at neuroplasticity or learning from the brain's perspective, it is consistency and consistency and consistency. Same with exercise. You can work out once a week or you can do a little bit 5 days a week.
Man, it ain't fair, but it is what it is, right? Tis what it is.
The last one I wanted to mention, because we're just doing diagnostics, I don't think optometrists do enough.
I want to hear it.
Is dynamic visual acuity testing. Mm. So the little car sick kid, you just have them reread your eye chart and shake their head side to side until they feel dizzy. So if they're 20/20, they should be able to get down to 20/25 without symptoms. And then if they get dizzy at like 20/80, 20/60, that's why they're car sick. And you can fix that for them, which making someone not car sick can really change their lives.
It's true.
But also then they have, it's easy, because imagine, so, and I always say this, so if someone can't move their eyes appropriately to read a textbook, they're going to use their head to move. But if every time I even move my head, I get dizzy, well, yeah, reading's going to be awful.
Yeah.
So literally kids are just getting, if they have car sickness, they're likely, and they're a head mover when they read, they're actually probably getting a little car sick when they read.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awful.
And all you have to do is have them shake their head.
It is, you know, as I started down this rabbit hole and now I've gotten your advice and I'm getting a little bit more confident. I still am like,
do you feel more confident or less confident?
I mean, now I'm like, wait a second, did I do everything I should have? Well, what it scares me is like, okay, I can tell that this is abnormal, but now what? Right. So maybe we do need part C or part three, but it's like, I always do feel this heavy burden when someone comes in with something odd like that, whether it's reading or whatever. And most people who have something going on, they want an answer, right? Like, why am I getting headaches all the time? And while you saying, oh, you've got healthy eyes is good, of course, because no one wants to have like a brain, a tumor or something. Yeah. It's also super frustrating when you just want an answer, right? So like, you want to be able to give, it's just a screening too, right? You are actually good. I've tested everything here. These are like, I'm not an expert here, but what I can see, things are okay. And especially like, I mean, where I am right now, I have no one to refer to, right? So I need to be able to now do this, right? But even still, when a patient comes to you in the middle of, you know, San Francisco or New York, like they came to you and took time out of their job and took time to take their kid out of school. Like they want an answer. They don't want to have to go find all these other doctors. So I do think incorporating even a couple of the, like, it may not, you may not start with all 10, right? Or however many you listed, but even if you get like 5 of them in, just to, you know, some of the big ones, it's important.
Yeah.
It's important.
And I really think that we have to do more of it because it's so prevalent. Yeah. I mean, it's so prevalent and we don't have enough people doing vision therapy. I think we need more clinical trials to show it's helpful, number one. 100%. And I think we need to do more home-based. Because home-based, it's prescribable. I see an ocular motor problem. I prescribe the treatment, which is vision therapy. I see glaucoma. I prescribe like a drop, right? So it's, to me, they're the same thing. I'm prescribing a treatment option, for people. So I think that unfortunately our profession makes it seem so complicated when we teach it in schools, and it's not that hard. And I know I say that, but I'm like, it's really not that hard. If you think about it from a, well, let's just boil it down to the basics. You know, I have an accommodative problem. Let's work on accommodation. I have a saccadic problem. Let's work on saccades. I have, you know, it's, you know, I tested it this way. So then you work on it.
Yep.
And it doesn't need to be complicated. It doesn't need fancy equipment. It doesn't need to be so laborious. And what I also, one of the things I hate about in-office therapy is you're taking the kid out of school consistently once or twice a week.
Yeah.
And that kid is probably already behind in school. So they really don't need to be out of school.
And to be honest, most parents probably don't want to have to come to your office that many times.
Yeah. Well, and let's be completely, like at Berkeley, right, I taught in the VT clinic on Saturdays. And like, yes, we made it fun for the kid, but who wants to be at VT on Saturday? No.
No kid and absolutely no parent. Absolutely yeah. no care.
And absolutely right. no student permission I had to teach.
Yeah, right? No. So. Right. No, no one wants to be there.
No. So how can we make it? And that's my big thing of, we need evidence behind it to show that it helps. We need to be able to show that it's easy, it's affordable, and it's something that is accessible to everyone. And it should be a right. Like I was talking to a couple of ophthalmologists the other day, and I was like, it should be something that is like, oh, you just go to reading eye movement therapy, and that's just like a program that you can do, and then it's over.
I like that.
Kind of like exercise. So yeah, but we can always talk about that some other time.
Love it, man. Whew. My brain's ready to explode. I think I have dyslexia after all that. And yeah, and it's just wonderful that, you know, you're bringing all this to everybody. When are you lecturing next? When can we see you on the podium?
Let's see.
Anything coming up? Academy, optometries meeting.
So I'm going to both of those.
Good.
Right. So that'll be fun.
There we go.
I'm lecturing.
D.C.?
Well, I'm lecturing in,
right? It's close to you.
D.C. It's close. It's right up the road.
Good.
I have a lecture every day at AOA.
Get
I'm pretty
out.
Excited.
That's Snaps. Exciting.
Snaps again.
Wonderful. Talking a lot. My PT is going to come. So if you guys care about
the cervicogenic
eye pain lecture,
very cool.
We're going to do it at AOA.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then I'm going to Arvo at the end of this month with Sea Light. So also fun, if you are at Arvo, you should stop by our booth, because we're looking at fixational eye movement, which is a whole other talk
Super cool. Very
cool. Unreal.
Amazing. Well, thank you again. I'm going to link your information for anyone who wants to reach out, and we'll see you next time.
Sounds good.
Well, that's it. Before we go, reach out to us for feedback, questions, stories, things you want us to talk about, either through email or on our Instagram or Facebook. We can't depart without saying thanks to Valley Contacts for their support, both the amazing lenses they make and the great people they are to work with. And be sure and tune and listen to our next episode. But until then, try not to blink.